United States' newest pariah. Though the country has been a battlefield for years, a jumble of Soviet tanks, freedom-fighting factions, and now the regime of the Taliban, it took one man, Osama bin Laden, to really get America's goat. Afghanistan used to be the victim, a struggling chit in the Cold War game of risk. Russia rolled into the country in 1979, while the U.S. armed the Mujahideen to fight back communist threats. But with President Carter's pronouncement, it was the 80 Olympics and not Afghanistan that changed.
I've sent a message today to the United States Olympic Committee spelling out my own position, that unless the Soviets withdraw their troops within a month from Afghanistan, that the Olympic Games be moved from Moscow to an alternate site or multiple sites, or postponed or canceled.
The Soviets must be made to understand that they will continue to pay higher and higher prices until they bow to the will of the world, cease their invasion, and withdraw their army.
Earlier today, the United States carried out simultaneous strikes against terrorist facilities and infrastructure in Afghanistan. Our forces targeted one of the most active terrorist bases in the world. It contained key elements of the bin Laden network's infrastructure and has served as a training camp for literally thousands of terrorists from around the globe.
3 years after 19 were killed in President Clinton's strike at the alleged Afghani school of terrorism, the mess in Afghanistan seems to be embodied by the rubble of Buddha statues in the mountains. Connection listeners, Afghanistan, pariah or victim? And what makes you, not your government, not the media, you, consider a country or a people the enemy? The number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined by Layli Helms, who's Taliban advisor in the United States, and from a studio in Washington by Julie Sears, a former analyst at the Department of Defense on Afghanistan. And in the studio I have Nayamat Nojumi, a former Afghan freedom fighter, and now a scholar and student at the Fletcher School for Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. Welcome to you all. But first I'd like to bring in Dick Hoagland, who's Director of Public Diplomacy for the South Asia Bureau at the State Department in Washington. Dick Hoagland, welcome to the program. Dick Hoagland, can you spell out exactly what U.S. policy is towards Afghanistan?
Yes, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to talk with you. Policy towards Afghanistan of the United States is also the policy of Afghanistan by the international community. We have absolutely no quarrel with the Afghan people, and we want to make that absolutely crystal clear. We do, however, have a quarrel with the Taliban. And the issues that we have with the Taliban are, first and foremost, their support for transnational terrorism, which includes providing safe haven for indicted terrorists like Osama bin Laden and others, and providing the resources for terrorist training camps on the territory that they control. But we also have issues with them on human rights, including the human rights of women and girls, issues on narcotics production and trafficking, and especially the ongoing civil war in Afghanistan, for which we have strongly pressed for a negotiated peace for a broad-based government that respects the traditions of the Afghan people.
But if we can separate those issues, I mean, you talk about human rights and women's rights, well, you could point the finger at Saudi Arabia. You talk about drugs trafficking, you point the finger at Colombia. The issue that does seem to be very different is Osama bin Laden. If the Afghan government, if the Taliban handed over Osama bin Laden, would that be the end of your dispute with Afghanistan? Would you say, yes, lift the sanctions and we'll recognize the Taliban as the legitimate government?
I don't think it's a question of recognition at this point, because we're dealing with two United Nations Security Council resolutions. Those resolutions do ask for Osama bin Laden to be handed over to a place where he can be brought to justice. But they also insist that the Taliban close the terrorist training camps in Afghanistan and that they cease providing training and support for international terrorists.
Let's bring in Layli Helms, spokeswoman for the Taliban in the United States. Layli Helms, what do you think about that? Do you think that Osama bin Laden is the core issue here? And if he is, why not say, hand him over? Or at least say, Mr. bin Laden, will you please leave the country? You're causing problems.
I think that the Osama bin Laden is very much the main issue, and the problems with handing him over is that the Taliban movement, the government that exists right now in Afghanistan, can't do it in absence of some kind of a judicial process. And the only choice they have is to do it extrajudicially. And their legitimacy in the country is based on Islamic law. They brought law and order back to the 90-95% of the country that they have. So for them to then go ahead and hand, you know, somebody who's wanted over would completely extrajudicially kind of bind him and hand him to his enemy would undermine their credibility with their own population. So what they're asking for is some kind of a process that the U.S. would agree to that would legitimize having this man come to trial.
In what sort of sense? I mean, are they asking for an official indictment from the UN or from a high court in the United States?
Well, so far the only thing they've received is the 130-page indictment. An indictment is basically an accusation. And they've also received a transcript of the Ali Muhammad's testimony and CNN tapes. What they are looking for is something that would be considered evidence of his guilt.
But that comes out in court. I mean, you're asking for the case to be tried before the hearing actually begins.
They've actually made three offers. One of them is to try him in Afghanistan if there's evidence. Of course, that was unacceptable because the U.S. government doesn't extradite, much less, have an extradition, much less recognize the government there. On cases of capital punishment, which is what bin Laden's been accused of, most of our NATO allies would not extradite a person. We have cases with France, for example. Ira Einhorn, who's convicted of capital punishment, and France still hasn't extradited him. So there's the whole issue of extradition and the formality of that, which doesn't exist between the two governments. And because that doesn't exist, the Afghans then proposed an international panel of Islamic scholars who would be presented some kind of a case, who could then say, okay, well, this man needs to go be tried.
Before I put those points to Dick Hoagland, can I ask you how you actually became involved with the Taliban? I mean, Leyla, have you been traveling in Afghanistan and as a woman?
Yes, I was living in Pakistan for about 6 years until 93, and that gave me the opportunity to go cross-border and work with women's projects there. And I've gone back since the Taliban have come in to survey women's projects. And basically, you know, from the perspective of someone who was there during the factional fighting and someone who went there after the Taliban came, the projects, the women I knew who were not part of the communist government, you know, really their lives didn't change at all. In fact, it's gotten better and more secure for them. The people, the women who were really affected by the Taliban coming in were the women who were part of the communist infrastructure left behind in Afghanistan. And the Russians never left. I mean, they kind of stayed there and backed Massoud. Massoud went over to the Russians in 1986, and they were basically backing him to create factional fighting against other groups. They kind of handed him Kabul.
Leyla Helms, we'll leave it there for the moment because I'd like to go to Nehmat Najumi, who was a freedom fighter in Afghanistan who came here in 1991. You're a regular visitor, Nehmat, to Afghanistan. Is that picture that Leyla Helms portrays, things have got far better since the Soviet-backed regime fell, since the end of the Civil War in which you were involved, is that true? Things are better for women?
At the beginning of Taliban movement emerging in Afghanistan, you could see some sort of a very short-term stability in the country, especially in the area that controlled by the Taliban. But in general, the Taliban being felled to provide protection for the Afghan citizens who were living under their control, and in two grounds. One, in legal ground, there are non-Afghan armed groups who came in Afghanistan during this period of time. They engage in using violence against the civilian population in Afghanistan, especially in the areas mostly in central Afghanistan.
But violence was nothing new for Afghanistan. They went through the civil war, the war after the Soviet invasion. They went through several years of war with the various Mujahideen factions fighting each other, far worse than during the Soviet occupation. Women didn't have a good time then, neither did civilians, did they?
But I visited Afghanistan in 95 and several provinces. You could see the majority of doctors in the cities and the other area were women. And having bringing security for women, it is not only to shovel them in their houses and close the door on them.
More on life in Afghanistan in a bit, but let's go back to Dick Hoagland at an earlier point. Dick Hoagland, you'll have been hearing what Laleh Helms of the Taliban was saying about due process of law. Dick Hoagland from the State Department, what do you answer to that?
I think that there are many ways that the Taliban movement in Afghanistan could resolve this issue, but I want to make clear that we're not focusing solely on Osama bin Laden. This is not a one-person, one-man issue. This is an issue of the Taliban movement providing support for transnational terrorism. They provide support for groups that stretch from as far away as the Philippines to Algeria. They are destabilizing the region with their support for terrorism, the support for the Uyghur separatists in China.
But many of these groups who have gone to Afghan soil, I mean, Afghan fighters are renowned worldwide as sort of exporting their special brand of warfare. But many of these factions were trained by the United States. In fact, the United States backed the Taliban, didn't they, in 1994?
Oh, but there's a very important distinction here. Afghans are certainly renowned as fighters, but they have never exported their fighting to other countries. And that's what's happening now that the Taliban have given territorial support for the training camps of other nations, fighters and terrorists, including Chechnya and Kashmir, many other places. There's another point I'd like to make in response to Ms. Helms. She has said that the situation has improved a great deal under the Taliban, especially for women. But I want to take a different point of view on
that. Could we stay on the terrorism issue, though? I mean, what is the real threat? Why is Afghanistan such a pariah in American eyes? What should America and, indeed, Europe be afraid of?
Afghanistan is not a... I don't like the word pariah. Afghanistan is a serious problem, not only in the eyes of the United States, but of the international community. When you have the United Nations Security Council passing two resolutions against the Taliban in Afghanistan, not against Afghanistan and not against the Afghan people, but solely against the Taliban leadership, there is an international consensus of terrorist activity, training in Afghanistan, and continued threats against places elsewhere in the world. For example...
But is the Taliban the threat as far as you are concerned, or is Osama bin Laden the threat? I mean, what is the danger here?
Again, we're not focusing solely on Osama bin Laden. The Taliban themselves are the threat in the sense that they are providing safe haven for indicted international terrorists, and they provide territory for the training camps for other international terrorists. This is where the problem lies.
Dick Hoagland, Director of Public Diplomacy for the South Asia Bureau at the State Department, thank you very much for joining us. We're talking pariah, or if you like, enemy, number four this hour, Afghanistan. Is it just the victim of a bad neighbourhood? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection on NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up in the second hour of The Connection, yoga. Everybody's doing it.
Judy Swallow, this is The Connection. The Taliban in Afghanistan, it's a phrase that flows off the tongue and causes the bile to flow in Western capitals worldwide. Why? Here's former President Bill Clinton on the day in August 1998 when the U.S. bombed Afghanistan in an effort to dispatch of alleged terrorist king Osama bin Laden.
No religion condones the murder of innocent men, women, and children. But our actions were aimed at fanatics and killers who wrap murder in the cloak of righteousness and in so doing profane the great religion in whose name they claim to act.
The United States may not like the Taliban's treatment of women, the war they've been waging, their connections to the opium trade, but the country's classification as major security threat is directly and singularly tied to the presence of bin Laden in the country. Connection listeners, does the U.S. have a policy towards Afghanistan, or simply a policy toward the head of this international terrorist network? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. My guests today are Layli Helms, Taliban's representative in the United States, Niamat Najumi, former freedom fighter in Afghanistan, now scholar at the Fletcher School for Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, and also Julie Sears, former analyst for the Defense Department on Afghanistan. Layli Helms, let me go to you first. Tell me about the leadership of the Taliban. Who exactly these people are?
The Taliban are basically the grassroots, the mid-level commanders who fought the Russians. Most of them were made up a party called the Harakat Islami. It was a moderate party, not influenced by the Muslim Brotherhood. They're kind of the grassroots infrastructure of the country, which is why they're able to control as much of it. They kind of bring people into the tent across ethnic lines and so forth. Afghanistan's a very hard country to rule. I mean, the Russians couldn't do it with 200,000 troops. Unless the people there accept the government, the kind of control the Taliban have, because it's so grassroots, they've been able to achieve things like a complete ban on poppy cultivation, which has been a problem endemic of Afghanistan from before the war, but increased tremendously during the war. And in the last year, they completely banned poppy cultivation, which brought a lot of money to farmers. They couldn't have done something like that unless they had, you know, kind of the fundamental elements of African society, which is the religious, the tribal, the trade community backing them.
Layli Helms, thank you, because I'd like to put those points to Niamat Najumi, who was former freedom fighter. In other words, he fought with one of the various Mujahideen factions in the civil war between the Soviet occupation and the Taliban coming in. Niamat Najumi, now I understand you don't really like the Taliban, but isn't it the case that they are probably the only group that could and has brought relative stability to most of Afghanistan?
The question is not here to like the Taliban or dislike. The question is that I think I'm one of those Afghans that who suffered by many years of war, and I feel myself very closely to the Afghan local community. And that's the position that I have here. I'm not really supporting any of the factions that who are waging wars against the will of the Afghan people.
But you want to go back to Afghanistan, but I would gather, that as you're here, that you don't want to go back while the Taliban are in control. Is that right?
The question is, the going back or not, it requires that what I can do for Afghan people. I'm looking for some sort of peace settlement and reconciliation in Afghanistan. And the people are sick of long years of war, and the local community, they do not have any voice, any choice in the political affairs of the country. In this case, we can see in Afghanistan what really happening now is the number of refugee population growing up, the number of orphanages are growing up, and the cemeteries next to each village and towns are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. It is not fair. It is not just.
Let's bring in Julie Sears now, who's traveled widely in Afghanistan, was former analyst for the Defense Department on Afghanistan. Julie Sears, welcome to the program. Thanks for being so patient.
Thank you, Julie.
I was going to ask you, how does the Taliban fit into the picture here? I mean, are they unmitigated bad news for the country?
Well, I would say from my own experience, yes. I would dispute the point that was brought up earlier, this idea that the Taliban have brought peace and security to most of the country. I would dispute the figure of 90 to 95% territorial control. For one thing, I've traveled in 25% of it that is not under Taliban control. But also in this area that isn't under Taliban control, I would say that there's much better peace and security than in Taliban areas, and yet without the harsh restrictions on women. And this is a very traditional part of Afghanistan. I mean, they're not under what Afghans might consider a very liberal westernized government. These are just local rulers. They're in line with Afghan traditions, and yet women are able to go to work, girls are able to go to school, but there's not this crime problem that people seem to believe only the Taliban can counter. And in fact, an aspect which I find particularly interesting in this idea of international terrorism that we've touched upon, and especially these foreign fighters in Afghanistan, is that when these fighters go up against the Afghans in the opposition, they tend to commit very horrible human rights abuses against the Afghan population, particularly against women in terms of kidnapping and rape. So,
but all the phases of the civil war have been particularly brutal. I mean, when the Taliban came into Kabul and effectively defeated the coalition of Mujahideen factions, the people cheered them.
Well, I'm not so sure that they cheered them in Kabul. I wasn't there at the time, but I've talked to a number of journalists who were. People sort of had a wait-and-see attitude toward the Taliban. And of the people who lived there at the time, I've talked to a number of them. What they really hated about living in Kabul were the constant rocket barrages by the Taliban, and the opposition does not have those sorts of indiscriminate attacks, certainly not to the same extent that the Taliban have. So people... life in Kabul now is better in some respects because of that, but yet at the same time, it's more like living under a police state. And as Mr. Niamat pointed out, the number of refugees from Afghanistan has actually increased under the Taliban, which, you know, people are voting with their feet, basically, that they don't like life under the Taliban.
Julie, thanks for the moment. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK to join the Afghanistan pariah connection. Andre joins us. Andrew, what do you think about Afghanistan and American policy?
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. My comment is that the United States presence has very little right to complain about the Taliban, because if you see, if you remember, those blessed this with a long enough memory must surely remember that the CIA itself worked to create the monster that is today's Afghanistan's ruling Taliban. The United States made a grave historic error by encouraging fanatical Islamists of all stripes to come to Afghanistan in the early and mid-80s, and the U.S. provided up to $3 billion for funding up... for building up the anti-Soviet Islamic network on the premise that the more fanatical they were, the more effectively they would fight the Soviets. Now it's totally out of control. And by the way, let me finish. The United States is making the same mistake by supporting the KLA in the Balkans. If you check the Interpol's website with the top 10 most wanted, you'll see that the Milosevic picture has been placed next to that of Osama bin Laden, known for his support of the KLA insurgents against the Milosevic-led Yugoslavia, the response to which got Milosevic in the trouble in the first place. To sum up everything, it's a very bizarre, illogical, and irresponsible policy by the U.S. based on a short-term tactical considerations rather than a long-term strategic vision.
And Andrew, thank you. I think I'd like to put that point, first of all, to Niamat Najumi. Niamat Najumi, do you accept that the United States helped create the Taliban? They poured billions during the Cold War to try and oust the Soviets. The various factions of which you are part benefited from that money.
That is true, and in some respect, but I would like to say that it was a strategic mistake by the United States to not supporting the Afghan Mujahideen, but...
faction, though? There were seven factions, seven major
factions.
I
mean, I'm talking in general, in all Afghan Mujahideen and the whole resistance movement against the Soviet. These are two completely cases, the Yugoslavia and Afghanistan. We have there more than 80,000 of Soviet soldiers armed and crossed the border, invaded Afghanistan, and knocking down the government and controlling the country. And the situation that we are talking here now is that, my point is... The strategic mistake that the United States made in the area during the Soviet invasion was that to leave or put Pakistan as a protector of U.S. national interest in the region. And the Pakistan got a very free hand, especially ISI, in the affair of Afghanistan. They intervene in every single decision that the Mujahideen leader tried to put together for Afghan people.
Are you actually saying that you believe that the United States channeled billions of dollars of funds into Afghanistan, yes, but left it up to various Pakistani regimes to administer the money?
That is absolutely correct. And you can see the distribution of arms and many came directly through the ISI to the Mujahideen, and there was not any independent or autonomous entity that provided those funds to Afghan groups. But I'm not saying that the Mujahideen resistance, based on the U.S. Financial support, most of the, especially in the first 4 years of war, the majority of weapons in our hands were captured weapons from the Soviet forces, and the local support that we have received from the local community in Afghanistan.
Andrew, I think the conclusion there was that things were pretty bad before the Americans got involved, but they might have made it slightly worse. But what do you think American policy to Afghanistan should be now, Andre?
Oh, I really have no idea on this one.
No idea. Well, let's go to Julie Sears quickly. Julie Sears, the Americans have got their fingers burnt many, many times in Afghanistan. Do you think they're taking the right policy now?
Well, I think we're starting to get toward the right policy, especially in terms of identifying the Taliban as much, if not more, of a problem than bin Laden himself personally. And I would certainly agree with Mr. Najumi's last comment.
So it is about the Taliban. It's not about Osama bin Laden. He's an excuse.
Well, I'm not sure if the U.S. government has entirely reached that conclusion yet, but I think slowly they're coming to the realization that bin Laden is not the only part of the problem, that the Taliban are at least as much a part of the problem.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Catherine joins us now. Catherine, what do you think about what you've heard so far about Afghanistan?
Well, I have a question. I work as an editor for international organizations. Many who have worked are currently providing aid in Afghanistan and have read background papers where they complain quite bitterly about the Taliban essentially ignoring their own people, that they say that the international agencies, in effect, have to take care of the Afghans, that the health conditions of the Afghan people is just atrocious. Their nutritional status is horrible. And it seems to me, if this is true, that the first responsibility of a government should be to take care of its own people. And I'm wondering if the criticisms are just, and what people think about it.
Thank you, Catherine. Let's put that question to the U.S. representative for the Taliban, Layli Helms. Layli Helms, do you accept that the Taliban are not taking care of their own people, and indeed they make it very, very difficult for international aid agencies to work there because they object to female aid workers?
First of all, I'm not a representative, just an advisor. The other thing on this issue specifically, let me demonstrate this through a story. The Taliban used to import medicine because the amount of aid that comes to Afghanistan is a fraction of the actual need. Most of the medical supplies came in on the open market. Afghanistan is a landlocked country, so the only way it can import things was through its planes, and it would fly medication in from Dubai and India, which has a very cheap market. A distant relative of ours, a woman who was a physical therapist in the hospital in Jalalabad, suffered from asthma. When the first set of sanctions came, the planes were no longer allowed to fly out. Her family would then mail her asthma medication, because even though she worked in a hospital, the kind of medication, asthma is not, you know, a common disease, so aid agencies don't particularly import asthma medication. The second set of sanctions came in, and it closed off, you know, more possibilities of people being able to go inside Afghanistan. About 4 weeks ago, this woman who worked in a hospital, who was educated, died of an asthma attack. We lost an invaluable, educated woman who was engaged not only in the hospital, but in community building projects in the area she worked in, for lack of medication.
Layli, I'd like to bring in somebody who sounds like a similar sort of person. Ziba joins us on the line. Ziba, tell us about your experience. Tell us about your point.
Hi. I'm an Afghan woman, a physician who came to United States about 2 years ago. And my question is for Mrs. Ziba. I want to give you a whole different picture of today's Afghan woman. Today's Afghan woman is hopeless, jobless, depressed, and starving. What the Taliban did when they took control over capital cities, they closed schools for women. They forced them to stay home. Doctors, engineers, lawyers, they are starving. They are committing suicide. When I left Afghanistan, when I studied medical school in Afghanistan, there were more than half of my classmates women. And today, all of them are forced to stay home. They have no even basic rights for human.
Ziba, can I ask you, until 2 years ago, did you live in Afghanistan all the throughout your life?
Yes.
And you're saying that things got much, much worse?
Much worse. Two of my own classmates, wonderful doctors, very intelligent, they committed suicide. And in a way that it is, I'm telling you that today's Afghan woman is depressed. If you study some of the latest studies about the neurological, psychological problems among Afghan women, it is alarming.
Ziba, thank you. Let's put that to Layli Helms, U.S. advisor for the Taliban. Not a complimentary portrayal of the country and women's rights there, she
thinks. Excuse me.
Yes, Layli?
Yes, Ziba, I appreciate the point you're making. One of the things that did change when the Taliban came in is that the women in Kabul who were a part of the communist regime were put out of work. But I've seen this with my own eyes. I've gone to 5 different provinces visiting clinics that I had surveyed before, hospitals. The women who were doctors and nurses and so forth are still working. Women have started working in the Ministry of Social Affairs, Ministry of Education, Ministry of Health, a couple of other ministries. The level of women working in income-generating projects have gone up. There was a real problem. Afghanistan had a 2% literacy rate for women before the war. When the war came in, the only women who had access to education were the ones who were part of the communist regime.
Layli, we've got to take a short break. We'll pick up that point afterwards. We're talking Afghanistan this hour, number 4 in our Pariah series. The numbers to ring, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up in the second hour of The Connection, yoga. Is it all about the abs?
I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection. In the Cold War, the enemy was the Soviet Union, communists, reds under the bed. These days, the perceived villains in Western policy, print, TV and film, are Islamic fundamentalists. Dangerous terrorists, oppressors of women, hostage takers. Are any of these slanders true? Most vilified, pariah number 4 in our series, the Taliban of Afghanistan. Do they scare you, anger you? The numbers to ring, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. My guests today are Layli Helms, U.S. advisor for the Taliban, Julie Sears, former analyst for the Defense Department on Afghanistan, and Niamat Najumi, former freedom fighter in Afghanistan, now at the Fletcher School for Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. Niamat Najumi, the conversation has already started on our website, and one of the things that people are very exercised about is the destruction of Afghanistan's cultural heritage, obviously the destruction of the Buddhas in Bamiyan. I mean, is that your big fear, that if you ever go back, there'll be very little of the country there to go back to?
That's absolutely true. The destruction of the Buddhist statues, it is deals more with politics rather than religion, and any other proclamation that the Taliban leadership are giving to the world. What many believe that underlined the reasons for destruction were, first, that the Taliban authority tried to get the support of the Council of Sheikh in Saudi Arabia, who are supporting the spread of Wahhabism in the many different areas. My take is not that Wahhabism is good or not or bad, but it is something that's very foreign for Afghans. And secondly, they try to support Pakistan against India. third, they try to rip off Afghanistan heritage, historical heritage. In this case, and it was not the first time, when in 1995 Taliban controlled Herat, they destroyed and painted with black on the finishings that done by the most famous artist for more than 11 years at the City Hall in Herat.
Leili Helms, the question is, why did the Taliban destroy the Buddhas? I know at the time they said that they were infuriated by an EU delegation who came and offered them money, not for the starving children of Afghanistan. They just wanted to preserve the cultural heritage, and this annoyed them. But, I mean, it was a bad mistake, wasn't it?
Oh, I think it was very harmful, and you know, certainly have great respect for Buddhism and its practice, but it was basically not done against the religion. The reason they gave, I mean, it was, you have to understand the mood in Afghanistan right now. There were 6 million refugees. Of the 6 million, about 2 million were still left in Pakistan until that last year. A lot of people went back into Afghanistan to kind of start their lives, and then the drought hit a couple of years ago, and it got worse over 2 years. The bin Laden issue, everything they've tried to resolve it, you know, they hasn't worked out.
It sounds like the behavior of a frustrated, bad-tempered child.
You're dealing with people who are watching their kids die of hunger and cold. I mean, I went from hospital to hospital. 80% of the women in the hospitals suffered from anemia, including the doctors themselves. The lack of nutrition, the lack of medication, the lack of, you know, being able to communicate with the outside world. This isolation has had an incredible psychological effect on the people inside Afghanistan. And the Council of Scholars is basically the parliamentary body. The government is split into three parts. It's the executive, you know, the Council of Ministers, those are the Taliban, the Council of Scholars, which is about a 400-person body. They're representatives from every district, from every province.
Leili, I'd like to get in some connection listeners. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Steve joins us. Steve, hello, what's your point?
Hi, Judy, how are you? My point is, there seems to be a growing and detectable antipathy toward religion, especially towards Islam. And do they view this as a struggle against Islam, against the Western Judeo-Christian world? Is this really a religious struggle? And do your guests see this struggle intensifying?
Well, indeed, Steve, because it's a case, isn't it, that terrorism is often said synonymously with Islamic fundamentalism.
Exactly.
Let's put that comment on that point, Julie.
Let's put that point to Julie Sears. Julie, is this a struggle, Judeo-Christian vilifying Muslims?
I would say it's certainly not, and I will admit I'm a bit disappointed in part by the way the United States occasionally has presented this issue and not emphasizing enough that the main opposition to the Taliban are also very conservative Muslims. They're also the heirs to the Mujahideen. Many of them were some of the greatest leaders of the Mujahideen. So the conflict in Afghanistan that's going on right now, the war, is certainly not between the Taliban and any other religion. It's not even between the Sunni and Shia parts of Islam, because the majority of people in the opposition are also Sunnis. It's really a matter, at least from the opposition perspective, of the Taliban being this sort of foreign-backed power, particularly, as Mr. Najumi said, a Pakistan-backed power. And the Afghans, as they always have throughout history, are very resistant to any kind of foreign domination. And that's what's really going on now.
But isn't there a perception in the West generally, and certainly in the United States, that Islamic fundamentalism is equated with terrorism? They are the new big enemy, and I think it's very misunderstood what fundamentalism means, isn't it?
You're certainly right. I do think it is a misperception, but it is a widely held, I think, unfortunate belief. Nevertheless, it gets to a fundamental misunderstanding of what's going on in Afghanistan now.
Yeah, if I may jump in on that.
Leili Helms, U.S. advisor for the Taliban, yeah.
Yeah, the Taliban, you know, especially are not anti-American. I mean, the progeny of the former Mujahideen, who are now part of the Northern Alliance, have a lot less good to say about America, and in fact are being backed by the Russians and Iran, who in that region are no friends of the U.S. interest. But basically, the Taliban represent a very rural, traditional Afghan movement, and in doing so, and in coming up from the grassroots, they rejected outside Islamic dogma such as the Muslim Brotherhood.
Let's actually pick up that point. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Obad, hello. I think you're addressing that very issue that Layli Helms was talking about.
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
Well, actually, my question kind of deals with the International Law Tribunal.
Mm-hmm.
And also the ethnic factor in explaining the current conflict in Afghanistan.
Yes.
So I would like to know, considering the recent grand policy success by international community in arresting Milosevic for his crimes against humanity, can we hope for, from an international law perspective, for a potentially similar approach towards the Taliban leadership, particularly their leader Mullah Omar?
Obad, what do you think the crime is?
What we've been talking about so far, their crime against people, their narcotics, terrorism, violation of human rights, various crimes we've been talking about so far.
Okay, let's put that point to Julie Sears. Julie Sears, I mean, is this going a step too far to portray these as a rogue regime?
Well, no, I think the last caller made an excellent point. In that the Taliban are also accused, and I think it's pretty well confirmed by organizations like the UN and Amnesty International, that they've engaged in ethnic cleansing. That's why the analogy to Milosevic is very appropriate in this case. And it's also appropriate to note that in the Hague War Crimes Tribunal, people from the Balkans conflict are also being held responsible for the destruction of cultural historical artifacts in the Balkans. And again, that ties in with this most recent destruction of the Buddhas. So I think there is a good case to be made in charging some of the Taliban leaders, particularly those we have on record as supporting these actions like Mullah Omar, for trying them in the future in some sort of international war crimes tribunal.
800-423-8255. Layli Helms, I can hear you.
If I may comment, that Mullah Omar so far hasn't made any kind of public statement on the statues. The quotes of him in the press are just, you know, inaccurate.
Mullah Omar's the Taliban leader, by the way.
The edict was actually passed by the Council of Scholars. In terms of atrocities and so forth, ethnic cleansing was par for the course during the factional fighting. In fact, the people whom Julie works with, Masood...
I don't work with those people, I should clarify that. I have traveled in those areas, though.
They basically, you know, killed 3,000 people of the Shia faith, you know, for politics. I mean, it was a pogrom that just they went through their neighborhood. Kabul has been turned to rubble between the factional fighting. I personally investigated rapes of women. So in terms of war crimes, I think that everybody in Afghanistan would welcome them, but they would have to be thorough and go into everything that's gone on there. I mean, there's a legacy.
A long, long past. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Aaron joins us. Hello, Aaron. Hello, Aaron.
Hello.
Hello, yes, Aaron. What's your point?
It's actually Arun from Boston. I just believe that the Taliban, they represent sort of an iconoclastic, militant, expansionist Islam, which is which goes against the trend of this global trend that we have liberal progressive democracies emerging worldwide, and I think that by and of itself, other than Osama bin Laden, they are a threat.
Are you saying that what you believe you're seeing in Afghanistan is similar to what we saw in Iran after the revolution there, that this is a regime that plans to export Islamic fundamentalism?
I think they're a more extreme version of what we saw in Iran. In fact, the leadership in Iran has called the Taliban medievalist, if that can be believed. I just think also that there is another factor that must be considered. I think the role of Pakistan in trying to almost sort of incorporate Afghanistan as its sixth province is deplorable, given their complete ignoring of the misery of the Afghan people.
Arun, thank you very much
right.
For that point.
Bye-bye.
I'd like to put that to Niamat Najumi, because Layli, I think I know what you would answer to that question. And Niamat Najumi, I'd like to hear from you. Do you feel it's rather sad that Muslims are being tarred with this same brush, you know, that Islamic fundamentalism, however you feel about the Taliban, that this is the sort of undercurrent here. There is this sort of prejudice in the West against Muslims.
Generally, the situation in Afghanistan projected some sort of reflection on the public opinion in the West, and especially dealing with Afghanistan, it is very sad for many Afghans, especially for our new generation in the United States and other northern countries. But the moment you hear Afghanistan, the world war, fanaticism, terrorism, drug trafficking comes along with it. And it is a very sad, unfortunately, projection in the public opinion, which is not really, in somehow somewhat is true, but is not Afghan fault. It is the people of Afghanistan. It is not their fault. And they really do not have any choice or voice in the whole process of war. And they are really trapped in this situation.
Leili Helms, U.S. advisor for the Taliban. Quick last word. The roving ambassador came to Washington to try and start a dialogue about Osama bin Laden, about all the issues between them. Was it a dialogue of the deaf?
No, I think it was very useful, and, you know, it certainly hasn't ended. I think it's going to be a process that needs to go on as this administration has their people in line. Right now, the approval for the level of people that the Afghans would need to deal with to implement any kind of policy, it won't happen until the summer in terms of congressional approvals or something. But just in case of where Afghanistan stands right now, Afghanistan, for example, has improved its relations with Iran. They're cooperating on drugs, and Iran is actually sending aid to Afghanistan for crop substitution projects.
Leili Helms, I have to leave it there so that Julie Sears can have a last word. Julie Sears, if you could give one piece of advice to the U.S. government or to the Taliban to break this deadlock, what would it be?
I think the U.S. should increasingly view the Taliban as the main part of the problem in Afghanistan, should work with those Afghans who want to create a genuine, broad-based, and free government in Afghanistan.
But they've been defeated.
Freedom.
Anyway, Julie Sears.
No, I wouldn't agree.
Julie Sears, thank you very much for joining us. Julie Sears, former analyst for the Defense Department on Afghanistan. I was also joined by Leili Helms, U.S. advisor for the Taliban. Here in the studio with me is Neamat Najumi, former freedom fighter in Afghanistan, now at the Fletcher School for Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. And earlier you heard Dick Hoagland, Director of Public Diplomacy for the South Asia Bureau at the State Department. Connection listeners, you can continue the Afghan pariah discussion at theconnection.org. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR.